Shalom and welcome again to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I am your host, Rabbi Richard Address. We hope to explore some of the issues that touch on our families, our communities, and ourselves as a result of the revolution in longevity. And you can contact us via our homepage, jewishsacredaging.com, or via our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. And we welcome your comments either on the voicemail icon on the website or to me directly at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And we now welcome to our Seekers of Meaning podcast microphones, Rabbi Jill Jacobs from Tru'am, an organization called the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. Jill, welcome. Welcome to Seekers of Meaning. How you doing?
Thank you. Thank you so much, Richard, for having me on. It's great to be with you.
So there is so much to talk about. Trua, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. Let's just, for some people who may not be familiar with Trua, what's the genesis of this? Where did this come from? How did it begin?
Well, Trua is an organization that mobilizes a network of more than 2,000 rabbis and cantors in the United States and Canada to bring a moral voice to human rights issues, both here in North America, where we live, and also in Israel and the occupied territories, where, of course, we have deep commitments. And we do that by organizing rabbis and their communities on specific human rights issues, by training rabbis and rabbinical students to be human rights leaders, and by amplifying the voices of rabbis and cantors as human rights leaders. So that's work we do. Trua has been around since 2002, so we're 16 years old. And we were started before I got here. I've been the executive director for 7 years. We were started by a group of rabbis who came together because they realized that there was a crucial need for Jewish clergy, rabbis, and cantors to organize and to bring a moral voice to human rights issues. And there wasn't an organization like that that brought together rabbis and cantors on human rights issues. And also, I would add that most organizations working in the social justice space work either on U.S.-based issues or on Israel-based issues. And we're unique in working on both because we live here and we have commitments to the place where we live. And also, we have deep commitments to Israel as the Jewish state. And so we work equally on both ends.
Do you have an office in Israel?
We have staff in Israel. We don't have a physical office, but we have 2 staff members.
And your physical office, I mean, the headquarters, so to speak, of Trua is based in?
In New York.
New York. The website, just in case somebody wants to get in touch with you who are not on your mailing list, your email blast, what is it?
It's www.trua, that's truah.org.
And where did the Trua come from for people who may have missed Rosh Hashanah?
Well, Trua is one of the sounds of the shofar. And the shofar, all the sounds of the shofar are a wake-up call to us, to wake up from, as Maimonides said, to wake up those who are slumbering, who are sleeping, to wake us up, to be aware of the world around us and to act in the world around us. So that's true of all of the calls of the shofar. Trua in particular is 9 staccato notes. So it's very, very short notes. And that for us reminds us of the brokenness of the world. So it's both a wake-up call and also a reminder of how broken our world is. And of course, we are committed to then fixing that brokenness.
The organization of Trua, Jill, non-denominational?
It's cross-denominational. We have rabbis from every denomination. So Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, Renewal, Reconstructionist, not affiliated, every kind of rabbi and cantor is part of Trua.
So it's rabbis and cantors. It's Jewish clergy, correct?
Jewish clergy, rabbis and cantors.
Right. And so modeling this concept of inclusion, which in our contemporary world, you know, stands as a beacon right now, since we're so divided in so many different ways. given the current climate, look, you're not bored, I guarantee you. And full disclosure, I'm on your email blast. I get the TRUA, and colleagues can sign up for that by just going on the website, correct?
Absolutely. If you go on the website, if you are a rabbi or cantor, you should see something in the website that says, click here to become a chaver, chavira. That's the language that we use for our members. So rabbis and cantors can click there and sign up. And if you are a Jew who is not clergy, we need you also. We absolutely need your voices. And you can go on the website and sign up for our list. And that will give us the opportunity to send advocacy alerts, information about specific campaigns, other ways to get involved, either online, locally. It might be anything from a rally that's happening in your local area to an online action to some educational materials to help you understand a particular issue from a Jewish perspective. We also send out once a week, we send out a short Dvar Torah, a short take on the parsha and the portion of the week written by one of our rabbis or cantors, and that take brings in human rights to the portion of the week. So you can also sign up for that and get a little bit of inspiration in your inbox once a week.
So a lot of organizations will have a headquarter office, and then they will have offices or staff placed around North America or the United States. Do you have a similar type of stuff? So in other words, if I'm a rabbi in Kansas City and I want to get involved, is there a local organizing agency, office, staff person, contact person in my part of the country that I can work with?
We don't yet have local staff, though hopefully as we grow, and we are growing, that's something that will be in the future. However, we do organize rabbis and cantors locally, and increasingly in a number of different cities, rabbis and cantors have come together to create what we call TRUA clusters. And anybody who is interested in creating a TRUA cluster in your region, which can work on local issues, even issues that we are not directing from the national office, can work on national issues, can work on Israel issues, you should absolutely get in touch with our office and we can help you to set that up. And we've seen that come into, and we've seen that in action, particularly around the crisis of family separation, which we first learned about this past June, that in June, in the week or so after we learned about the Trump administration's policy of separating families at the border and imprisoning parents in one place and children in another place, our rabbis and cantors in about two dozen cities organized or took part in local rallies in which they brought in their own communities. And that happened in New York and Philadelphia and Los Angeles and Elgin, Illinois, and really all over the country. And another group organized protests to coincide with Tisha B'Av. So that was something that we offered some advice and some help in setting up those rallies, but really it was our clergy around the country who took the lead and invited their colleagues and invited their own communities.
The website again, TRUAH.org, T-R-U-A-H.org. The phone number is, what's the phone number, Jill?
It's 212-845-5201.
What's the greatest challenge that you're facing right now in Israel?
Well, in Israel, we're seeing the growth, unfortunately, of an illiberal democracy, that the Netanyahu government is moving Israel farther and farther from its founding commitments to democracy and to human rights, and is following the lead of leaders like Putin and Trump and Orban, and in fact is allying himself with those people. And that is incredibly dangerous for Israelis, for Jews around the world, for Palestinians. And it's a real threat to the future of Israel. And that includes entrenching the occupation that has already gone on for 51 years. So the spread of settlements and the move farther and farther from a two-state solution. It includes crackdowns on people with particular political opinions. We're seeing that right now. There's an American student who has been accepted to study for an MA at Hebrew University, who, as I speak, has been in detention for 6 days at Ben-Gurion Airport, even though she has a visa from the consulate, I believe the Miami consulate, a student visa, because when she showed up at the airport, somebody found on a website, the Canary Mission website, that she was once part of a Students for Justice in Palestine organization at her undergraduate university. So we're seeing increasingly both non-Jews and even Jews, American Jews, and at least one case, an Israeli Jewish citizen who are being questioned on their way in and out of the country about their political opinions. That is not the sign of a democracy, and it's incredibly dangerous for the health of Israel. And so for us, that means recommitting to fighting for human rights in Israel, as well as, of course, in the United States. And it also means partnering more and more deeply with Israeli human rights leaders, because we see that the trends that we're seeing in Israel are the same trends that we're seeing in the U.S., namely that when you have a leader who is most committed to his own power and who is bringing an autocratic mode of leadership and who is taking the model of people like Putin and Erdogan and Orban as the model of leadership, that we see the same ways that that's playing out in Israel are some of the ways that it's playing out in the U.S. in terms of attacks on media, attacks on human rights leaders. And we're seeing the need for us as progressives to unite more and more, just as those who are supporting Trump and who are supporting Netanyahu are partnering more and more. So for us, we've dug into those relationships with Israeli human rights leaders and are learning from each other about how to address the move toward illiberal democracy in both of our countries and are standing up for one another when we get attacked in each of our respective countries.
We're speaking with Rabbi Jill Jacobs, the executive director of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. Jill, the challenge to democracy that so many people are concerned about and so many of our clergy are concerned about in the United States. As I said at the beginning, you're probably not bored in what
you are not bored.
Yeah, and I'm sure you're not. Talk to me a little bit about how the organization of TRUA is dealing with the Jewish community's, let's say, fractionalization, if that's a word, over so many of the issues that we're seeing, and especially in the last couple of months and really in the last couple of weeks. I know you just got off a webinar. The challenges to and the impending challenges to women's rights, civil rights, social justice. How are the individual colleagues being organized to deal with this? And following up, in talking with many of my colleagues, and I'm sure you talk to the same many of the colleagues as well, who are serving pulpits, who really have to, as has been explained to me by some colleagues, in many ways walk a very, very fine line as to how they preach, what they preach about, because of the constituencies in their own congregation. Is TRUA involved in, you know, what are the issues that you're seeing now, and have you been dealing with this challenge to colleagues' pulpit independence, let's say?
Well, that's a lot of questions in
one.
Maybe I'll start with the last one. There's confusion between what's political and what's partisan. So it's very clear that a rabbi, a minister, a priest, a cantor cannot get up on the pulpit and say, you should vote for so-and-so for governor, senator, president, whatever it is. That is very, very clear. And should not get up and say, Republicans are fill-in-the-blank, Democrats are fill-in-the-blank. That is clearly partisan. However, being partisan is different from being political. Everything that we do to try to create our society, to try to create hopefully a better society, is political, because being political is dealing with the polis, with human beings trying to live together. And it's clear that as rabbis and cantors, that we have a moral obligation to speak about issues that some might consider political and that I would say are also moral. Like, does our society have the obligation to ensure that everybody has health care, that everybody has enough food, that people who work full-time get paid enough to take care of their families? Those are so-called political issues, but they shouldn't be partisan issues, and they're certainly moral issues. When we think about, a lot of times we hear from our rabbis in particular, they'll say that people will say to them, don't talk about politics from the pulpit. I want to hear about Torah and not about politics. Now, if you took politics out of the Torah, you would have to take out
the Torah.
Certainly, you would most of the Torah. You would take out last week's Parsha, in which we learned that every human being is created in the image of God. And you would certainly take out the entire book of Exodus about liberation. You would take out any of the commandments that have to do with interpersonal behavior. You would have to then cut out all of Seder Nezikin, the section of Talmud that deals with torts and with interpersonal conflicts, and much of the rest of the Talmud also. Much of Jewish law, you would take out the section that's called Choshen Mishpat, which is all of the laws about how we're supposed to actually live together in society. So you would remove a huge amount of Jewish tradition if you didn't want to talk about so-called politics, and all you would have left behind is ritual. And that's a warning that we already heard from Isaiah on Yom Kippur, that ritual is certainly important, but ritual without any morality standing behind it is just empty. We need both of them. So to talk about Torah is to talk about morality. It's to talk about the ways in which we try to build a just society. In fact, as Jews, we're so lucky that we have thousands of years of this tradition of very smart people arguing with each other and trying to figure out together how it is that you build a society that ensures the most justice for the most people. And we have an obligation to draw on that tradition and not to put it aside. And of course, when we draw on that, we need to do it in a way that brings Torah, that brings all of our tradition, all of our wisdom to bear on today's issues. But that's certainly not being political. I would say that it's very much speaking Torah. You started the question by talking about the growing split, and I see that, and it's extremely concerning that once upon a time, it was possible to agree with people on one issue, but maybe argue about another one, to have coalitions in which people who agree on only one issue could come together around that issue and not deal with the other issues. And increasingly, we're seeing this split in the Jewish community, that you have a small percentage of the Jewish community, small but very vocal, that is willing to basically sell out all moral values and even in some cases to partner with anti-Semites, with white nationalists, to partner with people who are working to get rid of a woman's right to choose an abortion, even though Jewish law certainly allows for abortion and birth control, at least in some cases. So there are some people who are willing to put everything aside in order to partner with those who are supporting the Netanyahu government. And then you have the vast majority of the Jewish community that is not willing to do that. And you see a growing split between those two. And my hope is that our Jewish community will learn how to argue, certainly to continue arguing various issues, including or maybe especially our vision for Israel, and to come together around the issues where we've historically had very strong agreement, including support for immigration, support for women's rights to choose, support for religious freedom, etc.
Jill, do you think that there's a significant amount of the American Jewish community that has gotten to be very, very comfortable in their economic and social status and thus is afraid, and I use that word advisedly, to mount the barricades, so to speak?
That is absolutely the case. For years, there was a stereotype that said that Jews voted against our own personal economic interest, and that may or may not still be true, but certainly as we move farther and farther from the immigrant generation, we sometimes forget where it is that most of us came from. And have, for some of us in our community, we've developed this myth that our own parents and grandparents pulled themselves up by the bootstraps, came to the U.S. legally, and none of that is true. For those of us who have family who came before 1924, they were able to come to the U.S. because there were very few immigration restrictions. And of course, we know that once there were immigration restrictions in 1924 that were passed specifically to shut Jews and some Southern Europeans out of the U.S., we couldn't come, which meant that, of course, people who were trying to flee Nazi Germany couldn't get here. And then Jews were able to come only after the war when those restrictions were eased again. So we forget that. We forget all of the structures that allowed our own families to move into the middle class. Those include the labor movement. Jews were incredibly involved in the union movement, and that allowed us to earn wages that let us move into the middle class. Public schools, all of the structures that are being demolished right now are the very ones that have allowed us to move into the to the economic security that we now, that many of us have.
So you're saying that there is a sense of security, maybe it's false security in many cases, given the rise of anti-Semitism in this country. But am I hearing you say that this economic security has bred some sort of anesthetization on the part of a lot of the Jewish community?
Well, once we feel more economically secure, we forget what's holding others back. Or we look at ourselves and we say, I work hard, so I deserve everything that I get. And we don't understand that our society is not structured such that everybody who works hard can succeed. In fact, it's structured much the opposite, so that it's very hard to move up in economic class. It's very easy to stay where you are or even fall behind. Mm-hmm. And so we forget that. When I say we, obviously not all members of the Jewish community, but some part of our community, unfortunately, forget that. And then are perhaps less willing to fight for the institutions and the infrastructure that would actually allow the U.S. to give everyone a fair shake.
So we're speaking again with Rabbi Jill Jacobs, the executive director of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, main office in New York City. Website trua.org, T-R-U-A-H, and the phone number, if you want to get involved, 212-845-5201. If you go to the TRUA website, there's a whole series of programs that you are, I would imagine, ongoing programs, some of them very, very interesting. The title of which one of them, I need you to explain, called Tomato Rabbis. You're not mixing a salad, are you, of rabbi? What is the Tomato Rabbi thing? Very quickly. It's kind of interesting title.
Sure. This refers to a partnership that we have with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is an organization of agricultural workers in Immokalee, Florida, which is fairly close to Fort Myers in Southwest Florida. And these workers came together about 15, 20 years ago to start organizing in the fields. At the time, the Florida tomato fields were considered ground zero for modern day slavery. There was rampant violence. There was rampant wage theft. And they started organizing and created what's called the Fair Food Program, which is a program by which major corporations like McDonald's, Walmart, Trader Joe's, Taco Bell agree to a series of conditions that they will only buy from growers that have certain standards, including zero tolerance for slavery and trafficking, zero tolerance for sexual assault and harassment, paying workers on the books, etc. And the companies themselves also pay a little bit of money. It's around a penny a pound for tomatoes that goes directly to the workers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we about 7 years ago, started bringing rabbis down to meet with these workers. We've brought about 100 rabbis down over the last 7 years to learn from these workers and then to go back to their own communities and to organize their own communities to ask major corporations to sign on to the Fair Food Agreement. So we had a few years ago, there was a campaign to ask Trader Joe's to sign on, which they did. And we had rabbis taking their Hebrew school students and their congregants to their local Trader Joe's to deliver letters. We had rabbis and congregants organizing protests at Trader Joe's. And in the end, Trader Joe's heard the voices of their consumers and have been a good partner in this agreement. So that is our partnership with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. And over the last few years, it has expanded to include a coalition that includes us and a number of other organizations called the Worker-Driven Social Responsibility Coalition that is bringing this model into other fields, including most recently the first agreement in the Vermont dairy industry. So we're working on bringing what is the only proven way to eliminate slavery and trafficking in agriculture into, hopefully, in not too long, into the entire agricultural industry.
Jill, before you mentioned that one of the programs of TRUA is working in training future rabbis, cantors, etc. Do you do this independently of the seminaries? Do you do this in weekends, in seminars? This is really, really important, trying to plant these seeds into the next generation of Jewish clergy. How do you do that?
Yeah, we know that it is not easy to be a human rights leader as a rabbi and cantor, and it's something that requires specific skills that need to be taught, skills and experiences. We have two major programs for rabbinical students. One is a summer program that is highly competitive. We take 6 students every summer, so it's a pretty competitive process to get in. And those 6 students are with us full-time for 9 weeks during the summer. They spend 3 days a week working in a human rights organization in New York, so it could be an organization working with survivors of human trafficking. It could be an organization that's working on mental health issues in prisons. It could be an organization that's working on LGBT issues, all sorts of human rights organizations, and they learn about that work and those issues. And then 2 days a week, they're with us studying Jewish texts that are relevant, learning specific skills that they'll need as a leader, practicing even giving Divrei Torah, practicing giving mini sermons to each other and getting feedback on how that's going, talking to policy experts. They have a deeper understanding of the issues. So that's one of the programs that we have. And then we have a year-long program for rabbinical students during their year in Israel, which is a requirement of most of the non-Orthodox rabbinical schools have a year-long study program in Israel. And for those students, we offer once a month, we take them to see a human rights issue on the ground. So they plant trees with Palestinians in the West Bank. They talk to African asylum seekers living in Tel Aviv. They visit with Bedouin Israeli citizens in the Negev. They travel to Hebron with Breaking the Silence to learn about the ways in which the occupation is playing out there. And then we have intensive processing with them, both so that they can consider their own experience and also so that they can think about how they can use their own voice as rabbis or cantors to speak about these issues, ultimately in their rabbinate or their cantorate, but even before that, in their student pulpits, in their teaching, with their peers, with their families. And so that program, last year, about 70 students out of the 85 or so who were in Israel for the year took part in that program. So that has a pretty broad impact on the rabbis and cantors of tomorrow. And for rabbis, we offer sometimes in-person programs, sometimes it's a one-day training on a specific issue. In the last year, we've done 2 one-day trainings in the Midwest on anti-Semitism and on dealing with the new anti-Semitism. In 2017, we held two or three-day convenings, one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast, with training on a series of issues. We had one of our programs over the last 2 years has been a Jewish sanctuary network, synagogues that have committed to protect immigrants who are at risk of deportation. And we've done training both in person and online, both with rabbis and cantors and also with synagogue presidents and other leaders about how to turn their own synagogues into a sanctuary. We'll do online trainings. We just got off of a webinar following the Kavanaugh confirmation in which we talked about the ways that that's affecting our own communities and also talked about how to move forward into action. And so sometimes it's a one-hour webinar, sometimes it's a three-day conference for rabbis, everything in between. And then we have these two ongoing programs that have an impact on a very large percentage of rabbinical students.
So before we start running out of time, I just want to raise one issue with you and just get, you know, your take as the executive director of Trua. And it really reflects upon the constituency that Jewish Sacred Aging, you know, really looks at. And I run across this all the time as I travel for Jewish Sacred Aging. And that really is the economics of aging, the inequality of being able to afford quality health care. And I mean, I work with an organization called CTEC, and on my way to their annual conference in an hour or so, that really is focusing on this. And the Jewish value of tzedek and the idea of creating a just means to be able to afford to be sick in the country, which I found in our work is an emerging social justice issue. With a longevity, with extended lifespans, with the fact that the majority of baby boomers don't have enough money saved for their own retirement, how much the more so in case, God forbid, a real medical crisis. Is there any plans on the Trua horizon, given the aging of our own community and our median age of the Jewish community is 50 years of age? Is there any plans to really look at this from a social justice Torah-based, tzedek-based perspective?
To look at healthcare or to look at aging or both?
Yeah,
we certainly have materials on healthcare. It's really clear that it is, certainly there's Jewish law about how communities are supposed to take care of people's health needs. There's some really clear law and tradition about that, which I believe you can find on our website. There should be some teaching materials about that. We, in terms of the next healthcare challenge, we, as like other Jewish organizations, got behind ensuring that ACA would continue because it's one of the most important policies that has happened in our country in the last few years that finally, we have a system, not a perfect system by any stretch of the imagination, but a system that tries to ensure that everybody is covered by insurance. And there's lots of ways that we should tweak it. There's lots of ways that it could be better, but it's been a big step forward. And if and when there's the next attempt to get rid of it, we certainly will be fighting along with many of our partner organizations.
Rabbi Jill Jacobs, the executive director of Trua, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. And before we conclude, Jill, real fast, somebody wants to touch base with you, get involved with Trua, get on the mailing list, the email blast. How do they do that?
The best thing is to go to our website, which is www.truah.org, and you can find there everything you need to know about signing up for the email list and about getting in touch with us.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Jill Jacobs, the executive director of Trua, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. Continued success. I know this is a crazy time, and Mazel tov for all the good work that you and the organization does. I know many of the people on that mailing list for many, many years, some of them. So Thank you very much. And continued success. As like I said, like we've talked about, you're not going to be bored, especially in these next couple of years. So,
No, I think the fantasy of every human rights organization is to go out of business. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem like it's happening soon.
Yeah, I don't think so, given things. You probably have enough to do. So continue, just stay healthy. And that's the most important thing. And continued success. Thanks a lot for your time, Jill. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
And to all of you, thank you for joining us on today's edition of Secrets of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. This is a reminder that we welcome comments and contact at our homepage, jewishsacredaging.com, or to me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And we invite you to visit our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. Secrets of Meaning is produced by Steve Lubetkin and recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Thank you again for joining us. We look forward to greeting you on the next Secrets of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I am your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you and shalom.